Welcome to EA Business Radio. We are live here in Atlanta, Georgia, but we welcome our members all over the world. We welcome Shanghai University, who recently has come on as a EA academic sponsor. So we hope you all are listening in Shanghai, although you'd be dedicated members because it's about 1 a.m. in Shanghai right now. But welcome, and we got a great show today here. I think we got some the types of CEOs and leaders that's going to take Atlanta to another whole level. And I still say Atlanta's best days are ahead of it. And after today, I think you'll agree with me when you see some of the leaders that are making things happen in Atlanta. And we also got a little bit of local football here. We got a Georgia, Lewis Brown, the great Georgia Bulldog, great golfer, captain of the golf team. We welcome you. And we also got a Florida fan here, a Florida graduate. Scott Ellison. And Bill, where do you and I come in all this? Well, I went to West Georgia, so I can't claim a big football team. Then I went to Emory, so I mean, I never had a football team.
I went to Indiana, so I can claim a big basketball team, but I'll just stay out of the football talk.
I'll referee it since I went to non-football schools. You know, in Emory, in the charter, Woodruff put in the charter, they could never have a football team. That was written in the charter. So guess what? With that endowment, I don't think anybody's going to try to change that charter. That would be a big legal fight. But we do have some exciting things here today. And we want to start first by going around the room. Introduce yourself. And, Scott, we'll start with you. Just introduce us to you and your company.
So I'm Scott Ellison. I'm the CEO of East West Manufacturing. East West is a contract manufacturing company. We make other people's products. You wouldn't see anything out there with an East-West brand on it. And most of the products we make, I would say, are engineered products where we manufacture to a set of prints or specifications and standards that the customers require. And our products, for the most part, are made outside the U.S. We work with our customers to help them enter the world of globalization and to stay competitive. A lot of our customers struggle with staying competitive on their products, and so we facilitate that by having our own factories in places like China and Vietnam, and we're setting up in India right now. And so our job is to make products in those regions of the world where it's most strategically advantageous. And the name we call for this is domestic offshore manufacturing, which is kind of intentional play on words, which means we kind of take the headache away. To you as a customer, we'd feel like a local supplier, but we have all our operations offshore, and so we can enable kind of the best of both worlds.
Now, thinking of two words, a good idea and value, you hit both of those. I mean, that's a great idea, and you also are delivering a lot of value. I was an outsourcer. Insourcing, outsourcing, resourcing.
Yeah, there's a lot of words.
Of play on words, but it's really called a global economy. Mm-hmm. You know, many people forget when the Eastern European Wall fell and Russia fell, that opened up a huge supply of workers for the world, and we got a big supply of workers in the world. And that can be good news, and it also can be some challenging news. So I look forward to getting into Scott's business because I'm totally fascinated with outsourcing. Where'd you go in India? Bangalore?
I was in Delhi, Faridabad, which is just south of Delhi, and then Chennai. I spent most of the time in Chennai, which is the old Madras.
I guess Bangalore now is too metropolis, right? Is it too much? It's probably already had it.
It's pretty expensive.
It's pretty expensive, you know, now?
Yeah.
Wow. That means I'm pretty old. Because when I went to Bangalore, it was the area to go where it was not expensive.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but I now...
You know, it's evolving very quickly.
Evolving very, very quickly. Okay, Lewis, you know, you and Bill are partners, right?
Correct.
Now, what's the name of your company? Tell us, introduce yourself, give us a little bit about your company, and we'll let Bill finish up.
Well, Lewis Brown, and our business is 401k Pro Advisor. We are an advisory firm consultant to corporate retirement plans. Bill and I each work with individuals as well, but you know, we our business in the corporate world is retirement plans.
Okay, very good. Bill, what do you?
Well, you know, 401k Pro Advisor, everyone's heard of 401k, everyone knows what it is, but if you go back to the beginning of 401k, it started in the 70s, and since that time, the assets in 401k plans have grown to the trillions of dollars, but what changes have really been made in 401k plans and services? Not that much. And so we're really trying to change the way 401k plan services are delivered with the goal of improving participant outcomes, because this whole thing is really about getting the participants to retirement. That's what that plan's for. And I think the services that have been put in place so far leave out that important piece of how do we really make sure that the participant is going to retire, and our services take care of that.
Oh, very good. Well, that's with the excitement and pearls of the stock market today. I'm sure 401k, it's, people used to kind of put money in there and forget about it. Now you can't forget about it. Is that an obsolete strategy now?
Well,
buy and hold.
It's not obsolete, but it's certainly coming under a lot of question. It hasn't worked very well at all over the past 12 years. And the reason why is because at the end of 1999, the stock market was valued at perhaps 35 times earnings. People thought, or some people were making the case that was sustainable, or that you could justify that based on some sort of new world we were going to experience in terms of growth rates, and of course the internet was going to change everything. But the truth is, you know, buy and hold, in our view, only works for people with a very long time horizon. So Bill and I believe that portfolio management should involve some more degree of active management, where the strategy at least looks at investment conditions versus, you know, what you call buy and hold. Pretty much says we're not going to pay attention to what's going on with current conditions, and we're just going to let this static asset allocation ride.
I guess Buffett, he sits out there and eats his Dairy Queen sandwiches and drinks his Coke. He still does buy and hold, right? I mean, everything I'm seeing here, yeah. He's a believer in it. He's a huge believer in buy and hold. And really,
let's
really
drill down into what buy and hold means. So when he buys a stock, and let's pick one, Coca-Cola, he's going to hold it for a long time, right? So he's made the decision that this is a great franchise. The price is super attractive, so no reason to sell it. We're going to let it realize its value over time. But I would argue that he's a little bit of a market timer too, in that he holds a lot of cash at times, and he waits for the deals to come along.
That's a good point.
Yeah, when he did his deal with Goldman Sachs, first he got a deal that no one else could get, right? And he did it at a very specific point in time. He took advantage. I mean, that's market timing, mm-hmm. right? And he did something that the average investor can't do.
Yeah, and if you look at that deal, there were some very specific times in that deal when the interest rate was due and when he would be paid back in a balloon payment. So maybe you're right, Lewis. Maybe he's not such as a buy and hold strategist as some make him out to be. But all right, well, very good. Now, how do you do investment with your company? Let's look at this. Let's get back. I got a lot of entrepreneurs listening right now, so they hear this wealth 401k, and many of them are quite confused about what to do. And Scott, what do you, as an entrepreneur, you're a good entrepreneur, how do you handle that?
Our 401k?
Or how do you tell employees to manage the money yourself?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's important when we pick the plan that we have, that we had a nice offering for them that we all felt good about. So, and I think this is our third plan that we're on in the last 10 years that we've switched to, I guess, 2 years ago, and people are really happy with it.
It's good.
And it took a while and a lot of incentive. We really want everybody to participate, and so I think in some amount we provide for that. In other words, we'll give them money even if they don't want to participate. We'll put money into their plan, and we have a very attractive matching.
Oh, very well. So you're a big believer in
yeah, absolutely.
You're a big believer
absolutely.
In it. Yeah, it's I am too. Now, if the market goes down, they kind of get they start looking at the company and say, why did you pick this plan or whatever. But for the most part, people now know the market's going up and market goes down and just not it doesn't cause as many problems unless you have a catastrophe. I remember in 2000, you know, when the market crashed, I had a 401k plan, and it really put some scare into some people. You know, what should I do? What should I get it out? But other than that, the regular ups and downs people go along with, is that right? Is that what y'all see?
Well, first of all, the drop in late 2008 was dramatically more severe than the one you mentioned in 2002. Ended up, the market dropped about 45%, but it took it quite a while to get there. It took it really 3 calendar years to do it, but or maybe two and a half. But in 2008, really over 2 quarters, the market dropped about almost 40%. So that one was scarier from the standpoint of worrying about absolute calamity. But we shouldn't equate investing with the stock market. The stock market is one of the places people can invest, you know, in funds or individual stocks or whatever. But that's another thing that we bring with 401k Pro Advisor is trying to bring more options to the table. Bill and I looked at each other a couple of years ago, and we worked with 401k plans, but the common 401k plan really just gave people stock market and bond market options with really nothing in between. So you were at really two ends of the risk spectrum. So investing really should bring into play a lot of different strategies. And you know, as the stock market has gone down in recent years, the bond market has done very well. And then there are some strategies that have managed the downside. So,
yeah, I'm just seeing a lot of entrepreneurs are scared of the 401k because they don't want to be, you know, looking at employees when they lose if it happens to go down. You know, sometimes entrepreneurs are a little bit control freaks, just a little bit. So they are more skeptical of it. Whereas 10 years ago, you joined a 401k and you didn't even blink. You know what I mean? You just get in.
Correct.
But let's get back to that subject because now you came from Boston Scientific.
Were you? I started there. I was at Boston Scientific, and then I moved on to PricewaterhouseCoopers.
Okay, out of University of Florida,
right.
You went to Boston.
My first job was acquired by Boston Scientific while I was there. When I started, it was American Home Products, and then it went to Boston.
Oh, really?
Scientific.
American Home Products?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. We made minimally invasive disposable surgical equipment.
Yeah, very good company. So yeah. Was that a public company at the time?
American Home.
American Home was.
And Boston Scientific is as well.
Yeah, now Abbott bought Boston Scientific now.
Yeah.
So
when I started there out of college, they had just been purchased for $178 million, the four guys that started it about 5 years earlier, and they took 30-some million for themselves, and they gave another $30 million to the first 100 employees. $30 million cash.
At American Home Products?
Yeah, and I was employee 108.
Oh.
So I missed it out entirely, but it was a great experience.
So now you started your current company. How did you start that? What prompted this idea? Where'd you get your first customer?
So everything is, my career is kind of been building on itself. I made the medical instruments in Miami for a while, and then I was a supply chain management consultant for PricewaterhouseCoopers, and then I started my first company with my brother in the mid-90s and or later 90s, and he had been living in Taiwan and Hong Kong for 14 years when he and I started. And we got our heads together, and I was tired of traveling with Price Waterhouse. I basically lived on an airplane as a consultant, and we were both engineers, and he had a lot of contacts throughout Southeast China, and he said, well, what if, you know, at this time, you know, China was getting pretty good at making toys, and I understood the cost of manufacturing and efficiencies, and I had done some tours throughout China and had seen some of the factories with my own eyes, and I believed that we could competitively manufacture products in China and really help some of our customers here stay competitive. And so that's what we did. So we started our company. The company was called ITS, International Technical Services. And we made a circuit board that went into Buicks and Cadillacs. And then we got a nice project making a cruise control that went into the Corollas and the Camrys. They were installed at the ports, and that gave us a lot of credibility. So that really was my entree into global manufacturing. And then my brother was trying to make us .com in 1998 like everybody else, and I was interested in staying in manufacturing. So I ended up selling my shares back to my brother, and I went to our largest customer, a company here in Atlanta called Diversitech, and I joined up with them as an officer, and I built the offshore program for them from 98 to 2000. And I saw how much value we were adding to they're in the air conditioning business. Mm-hmm. And I saw we were adding a lot of value. Their business was really accelerating very quickly. And I wanted to take the whole concept of starting East West was taking the model that we'd really fine-tuned under the Diversitech structure and taking that out and offering the service to other industries in addition to Diversitech. And so we ended up setting up basically a joint venture between myself, Diversitech, my former employer, and a couple other guys from Diversitech. And that's what gave birth to us in 2001.
Do you know the most successful route of people starting businesses? You know, people start businesses all the time, but you know where one that you can count on it being probably three times more likely to be successful?
What's that?
When it grows out of their current employment.
You know what you're getting.
You know what you're getting. Mm-hmm. I left UPS, and I had worked on software for 10 years. And when I left UPS, we still built software. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I was so lucky about and undervalued at the time, but I took my first 32 employees from UPS. They decided to outsource everything. So, really set me up nicely. Of course, I didn't know anything. I didn't know how lucky I was. But still, I mean, we all came out of UPS, and we were working on this software project. But
And you had a loyal customer in UPS, right?
Well, UPS did not come a customer till 2 years later.
Okay.
That's one thing we didn't have. We didn't have a customer. That was a problem. But we had to go out and find one.
Mm-hmm.
You say American home product. It was American business products. Ron Ford was the CFO that gave us our first multi-million dollar contract. And that was exactly 11 months later. But it still was the culture. We left and we had a culture day one. There was a culture there.
Mm-hmm.
Doing it a little bit differently some other times now. You know, Network D, I went out and took over a company that had already a culture that was had its ups and downs, and certainly a good group of people, though. But to get to the point, so you basically, when you left Diversified, is that it?
Diversitech,
sorry. You came out of there and started your business around the same realm of business.
It was critical. That, in some respects, this is something we really wanted to do. I mean, we wanted to go out and offer this service to other industries. But it was incredibly important that we have Diversitech, we maintain the Diversitech relationship for a couple of reasons.
Oh, you had that as a customer.
You did
have Diversitech.
Yeah, when we left, we worked out kind of a brother-in-law agreement with them that says we want to continue to provide the services that we were doing internally, which really gave us a lot of did a lot. I mean, it covered half our overheads. It gave us a lot of credibility.
You can be successful with this type of arrangement.
Yeah, it was great, and we've really preserved that relationship through the years. And they've been a great partner, and we're both very valuable to one another today. I'm on their board; they're on my board. And both of us have grown quite a bit over the years.
That's such smart business. You know, people leave mad, and I'm not going to let you do this. That's nothing but a nosedive for everybody involved. But to do something like that it's just smart business.
Well, when I started that first company with my brother, I kind of learned a lesson there because we had no capital. We just had time and a very small budget. And it was, I was doing everything from taking out the trash to, making the sales calls and trialing over to factories and setting up the assembly lines. And I didn't want to have to go back to that again. I wanted some capital just because it takes, you know, I think we could have done it, but it just takes so much longer and so much more energy to get a company off the ground when you got nothing.
It's always more, takes more money and takes more time than we can ever imagine. And that's why I see a lot of new companies, great ideas, you know, great markets, but when I look at them and see that they're starting from scratch, I go.
You know, we get this a lot in our business where you get a lot of inventors that come up to us and they show you this great product and they say, "Hey, everybody in the world needs one, right?" And and they're so emotionally attached to it. Yet, you know, it's almost the same story with inventors. They've got, you know, great passion, great ideas, but they've got very little capital, and they've got very little know-how on how to take a product into, you know, not only through production but into the market. Mm-hmm. And so often when we are encountered with it, well, usually we try and run from inventors, but when
entrepreneurs do a good job of that.
Yeah, but when somebody's really wanting to, usually the advice we give them is go out and find somebody that has a portfolio of products or a channel that you can leverage and sell it to them, take a fee, and let them put it in their portfolio products that they're selling, and you may not get the 40-50% margins, but you're going to get so much more volume, so much faster, and have such a bigger chance of success that it's generally the way to go.
Absolutely. You want to start a business, go find a customer, right? Mm-hmm. So, Bill, now, when did you start your firm?
I've been in the investment advisory business since 1993. And it's, you know, it's like anything, it's changed over the years. I had a big interest in financial planning in the beginning and sort of changed into more investment management portfolios. And then, you know, probably about 4 or 5 years ago, as the rules and laws were changing around 401k and the Department of Labor was trying to figure out what level of services could be permitted so as not to get the employer in any trouble, I sort of saw the writing on the wall and said, again, we've got this aging population marching towards retirement with these growing balances with no pensions for the first time. And there's really, you know, nothing's changed in 401k. We call it buy and hope, not buy and hold. And so there's no strategy in terms of how those people are going to manage those assets. There's usually never effective cost controls in the company as to what it's costing. So, you know, we say to our 401k clients and to the CEOs, you know, if I was going to manage your money, if you gave me your portfolio, you'd have a certain list of requirements in terms of how that was going to be done. Why can't we do the same thing for our 401k plans? And most of the time, it's not being done that way. So, you know, the individual investor that's got a $1 million portfolio gets a better solution than a 401k plan that's got $10 million across the entire plan. But yet each participant obviously has a lot less.
But isn't your whole industry overlaid with this whole Wall Street ordeal? I mean, did you read Friedman's article yesterday in the New York Times?
I didn't.
You got to go back. Everybody that owns a business should read Friedman's article yesterday in the New York Times. It was incredible. He said with the Wall Street, he made two visits. He says, I'm reporting on two visits. I went to Wall Street, then I went to Silicon Valley. And Wall Street is just a shrinking group of people who trying to hold on to the past and they never added value, they never made anything, they never produced anything. In fact, he went back and traced the history of Wall Street was started by, you know, J.P. Morgan and them to finance new industries to replace old industries. And he says to find that today, you have to go out to Silicon Valley. And then he described his visit out to Silicon Valley where, you know, and this is the part everybody should read. He's described how new industries and education, every group is popping up because of the convergence of not just social media, although that's important, mm-hmm. but the convergence of cheap wireless connections.
Well, he said they're having a rebirth, basically.
Yeah.
And he also said a lot of folks from Wall Street were actually going out there and starting companies.
Yes. He said that there's a lot of folks who would have been financial engineers that are now going out and being, you know, technology engineers and creating value. So, I read that, and I listen to CEOs, I listen to our members, and the credibility. You know, if you're going to sell something, the first thing you got to have is some credibility. How do y'all tackle that? And I know both of you have got sterling records, which I can say this to you because of your outstanding records and your integrity and the way you've done it. And the big news is you've stayed independent, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
When you could have gone with the big guys. And so how do y'all get over that? I mean, as entrepreneurs, both of you are entrepreneurs. I mean, I know you both very well. Lewis, you've been a member for 3 years now, and so how do you, that's a, just being in sales myself through the years, I know, and you got to, I faced this in software toward the end where you go out and sell software and they go, oh my gosh, that Oracle salesperson, that PeopleSoft salesperson just ripped us off. and I would go, don't put all of us in software right. in the same bucket here, right. I stayed at 2 o'clock this morning. I was pulling my hair out, solving bugs in the program, But the people do tend to put you in right. buckets. Well, all right, enough of me talking. Go ahead.
Well, it's a great question, Bill. You take it first.
Well, yeah. And I've always approached the business from the standpoint that I wanted to be independent because I was sort of the anti-Wall Street. So, that's just the way I've approached my practice. Certainly, I've relied on a lot of things that come from the Wall Street industry, but I've never, ever been willing to give up my independence. I've never had to sell something that someone told me to sell. And the way we manage our practice now and the way we manage money is purely, from an independent, non-proprietary, objective standpoint. But with the 401k, your comment in the beginning, you're dead on. It is Wall Street. In fact, 401k was started by Wall Street. You go back to, a 401k is a complicated structure with thousands of employees. Well, who had the technology and systems to do that? The big mutual fund companies. So they basically said, hey, this is a great opportunity to grab assets because we have the technology backbone to do all this. So, most people, when they think of 401k plans, they think of mutual fund companies. They think of the big companies like Fidelity and all those other companies. So it has become a big just distribution arm for Wall Street. And again, we come in as a completely different source to the retirement plan, to the company, to the sponsor. We come in as what's called a fiduciary. So we actually work for the company. We have actually a legal obligation to the company. We don't work for a broker. We don't work for anybody else, specifically not, Wall Street or any mutual funds. So that allows us to deliver a fair, service, and we're actually required to make sure it's priced appropriately, which is one of the requirements of ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act. So we really are, and that's
wait a minute. You have to show how much commission you get.
We show the fees that we charge because we don't charge commissions. Actually, we don't take commissions. We
but
don't
brokers
take finder's
charge
fees.
Commissions.
The brokers charge commissions.
They don't show what?
No, they don't.
But why don't they?
Well, funny, they're going to start having to show it next year with some new rules the Department of Labor crafted just for that reason because they realize
most
compensation.
I bet you Geithner will be talking in Obama's ear about getting that thing deleted out of there. Geithner and Rubin, Paulson, those guys. And so we had something slip through. And knowing Obama, give it to me, I'll sign it. That thing's going to go away. There's no way Morgan Stanley and those guys are going to let that happen.
Yeah, there's a lot of lobbyists involved in
there
that.
There are a lot of lobbyists involved with
it's
that.
It's funny you say that because it's supposed to already be in effect.
It's already been delayed a year.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Right.
They're
and,
not.
And we can't leave out the insurance companies, which have probably been the worst when it comes to that.
I had about 600 people on a 401k plan, and I didn't realize until when I was selling the company, when we had to do due diligence, mm-hmm. I realized how much commission this sales guy was making.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I want the guy to make money, but I about went through the roof.
Yeah,
saying, "You mean to tell me you're making this? You should have just gone to Bahamas. Sign me up and go live in Bahamas because this is insane."
Well, that's common. See, he probably set you up on a fee structure that was based on a percentage of assets, and your plan was probably not very big. So he just kind of quietly left it in place, over the years, and you're playing.
Oh, as it grew.
Now,
you didn't come back and say, hey, Oxford, wait, we can cut you a break here.
That's probably, you know, that's probably what they should do. And if somebody else had come in and competed for your plan, you know, they probably would have exposed that. But
you know what, CEOs are like, I don't have time for this, man. I'm building a company. I mean, I got people all over me all day long. I got customers. I mean, 401k, go talk to the CFO.
That's right.
Yeah. You know, I had a similar experience. I was shocked with our first plan. It took a lot of work to figure out what the load was on it between the funds and the administrator. But once I got the number, it was over 2%. It was like 2.3%. And then I forgot the rule, but over a lifetime, you know, that 2% works out to be almost, I think, more than half the value of the growth over time. And I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
And it's so hard to get to that number, you know, for somebody to tell you. And we were able to get it under 1% now, and we're pretty happy with that. But it's
under 1%, that's good. You know, the newest trick they're doing out there right now is with the CEOs tell me, the financial advisors, and I'll let Bill and Lewis refute this because I know you guys specifically don't do this. This is why I'm bringing it up. But, you know, they go to you and they go, well, we'll take 0.8% of your overall assets as a fee, 0.8%. But then when they go to the mutual funds pay them extra money. You know, they get 2% of that. So your real fee at the end of the day is like 3.8% of your assets.
Right. What you're talking about is called revenue sharing. So what we run into a lot is we'll sit down and talk to a CEO or a CFO about their retirement plan and say, well, how does your vendor get compensated? How do they charge? And he'd say, well, it's free. Or they'll know what they write a check for, and it may be just a very modest amount. So as you said, the revenue to the vendor comes from the mutual funds. So let's just take the biggest mutual fund out there. It's called Growth Fund of America from American Funds.
American Funds, yeah.
Okay, so you'll find that fund in a lot of 401k
Clark
plans.
Howard recommends that.
Does he? Okay. Okay. Well, he likes it because it's cheap.
But they had such a great record, but they actually have had some issues in the last couple of years. I have some money in American funds.
Right.
Now, their staff is real small. I looked at their overhead and everything, and Howard was dead on.
American funds?
Yeah. They got a very small staff compared to how much money. It's kind of Buffett-esque-like. You know, it's just a few of them out there, and they got a lot, billions, But they had some issues in the past couple of years.
Yeah, I mean they had outstanding performance, but they had a history of not losing as much when the market went down.
That's what I'm talking about.
But then in the 2008 bear market, their funds went down as much. So they're style managers. They're going to be in the market. The market's very correlated today. It's hard to find anywhere to hide when the market's down. But back to the point on Growth Fund of America. We can get the institutional share of that. The class of that fund that doesn't have any revenue sharing in it is 35 basis points, 0.35%.
That's what I paid for it.
But we'll typically see that fund in a plan at something closer to 1%. So the difference is revenue sharing, and that's what goes
Because I went out to the Internet and signed up via the Internet for American funds. And paid like 0.35 or 0.25, something like that, based on Clark Howard's recommendation. Simple man, like Bill O'Reilly says, I'm just a simple man.
Yeah.
I listen to Clark Howard.
Right.
But now let me ask you this though: is our audience here are fast growth entrepreneurs? Should they have a financial advisor? I mean, is that practical? Should they? Let's say most of their wealth is in their business, and you know it's kind of a strange life. You know,
right.
You run along on a shoestring. You don't really have that much revenue, but overnight, they could sell and have $30 million.
Sure.
So during that time, you don't get a lot of calls from financial advisors until that night happens. Seems like a smart strategy to me is if financial advisors went to them and said, hey, I know you don't have $50 million a day, but can I help you here? You know, let me be of value to you. Let me advise you on some things. Is that maybe that's too pie in the sky.
The answer to your first question, though, is should they have an advisor? Is absolutely that they should have an advisor. Now, they should pay reasonable fees for that. But a financial advisor should be doing more than doing investment strategy. So the person you talked about is an entrepreneur who has a business, and they have a lot of issues other than how to allocate investment assets. And as you said, they probably aren't that liquid, so there's maybe not that much to even invest. But financial planning involves a lot more than just how to allocate a portfolio. So the main reason I think they should have an advisor is because the mistakes that they might make can be devastating. And it's always good to have somebody who's smart and trusted.
All right, let's turn to the entrepreneur here. Scott, what do you think? Would you advise, yeah. you've had your company now for 10 years.
10 years. Most of my assets are in the company.
Most of your assets are in the company, okay. And is there a time, because I'm just being a little counterintuitive here. Everybody thinks about financial advisors after the liquidity event. Is there any value, or does it distract from the company prior to the liquid event? Because
I think I have a financial advisor. He doesn't have a lot of money from me, but two reasons I'd say yes. One is you want to have that relationship and somebody you trust, so that one day when you hopefully do have some money, that you know it's going in the right direction, and also so you can get educated about it and understand, you know, how what the different philosophies are out there and understand what's best for you. The other thing that I believe in is the more you can pull from your company such that all of your, you know, retirement wealth isn't based on some liquidation date, the better, more flexibility you have when that day comes.
Absolutely. You know, I almost tell people to never just plan on it happening, because the folks who plan on it happening does it rarely happen to.
Or is it enough?
Or is it enough? That's right.
After tax.
You know, start planning as if you're not going to have the liquidity event, but you still need retirement and you still need everything. And simplify it. I had UPS stock, as I used to tell my wife, Karen. I said, you know, if we tank this thing here, if we go down, we'll have a few months of mortgage in the bank. We can pay the mortgage. The kids will still go to school. Mm-hmm. And that gave her enough to be, you know, where she was pretty comfortable with that and let me go out and do some crazy things. So I think Lewis and Bill could play this to entrepreneurs. Both of you are entrepreneurs. And I think there's, you know, instead of the 8 Goldman Sachs guys showing up at my door the day after I have the liquidity event, and I go, all these are expensive suits. Who's paying for them? I think there's room in there for that entrepreneurial financial advisor to growth companies. And you know what? I think they would pay for that. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't have a lot of assets.
Right.
But, hey, I'll pay you a fee until I get some assets.
Well, I think Bill and I have both had relationships like what you're talking about, where we knew people who could use our services, and we just work with them on an advisory role. It may be for a flat fee, but it's pretty lonely out there if you're doing it all by yourself. It's nice to have somebody.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think so. Like setting up 529 plans for your kids for college. You know, that stuff takes a little bit of setting up, go through it, estate planning, just stay out of the lawyer's offices, because everything you need to know about estate planning, you can know in 30 minutes. I mean, quite frankly, I don't care how rich you are. 30 minutes, if somebody would just tell you, but...
Well, once you hit that big liquidity event, then, you know, there's some more advanced things that you could do.
There is.
Depends on what you think about estate tax. I mean, that's all, but...
You know, you're right, but you're right, Lewis, but yeah, if you do that, there's also consequences over here on the other side that says, why did I just do that? Mm-hmm. You know, the government's gotten pretty good about eliminating loopholes. Mm-hmm. You know, that you're going to pay some taxes when you have a liquidity event. Mm-hmm. You know, I think you have horse farms and tobacco farms and all the big write-offs.
For capital gains to avoid that.
Yeah, you know, because I remember I told my CPA, Boutwell, I said, you got to be kidding me. You're not saying I'm writing this check right now.
When you sold, it was probably 28%, maybe?
26,
cap,
I believe.
Cap gains was?
26 or 28. But he says, and they're over there, they're state tax, too. Don't forget about the state tax.
Right.
That's another 6%. And he's really good. I mean, Jack Boutwell, I think he's the best. But he goes, you know, at the end of the day, you're going to write this check.
And you should have waited until Bush came into office. You just saved a lot of money.
It's true. But so I just get, you know, this is an entrepreneurial show. So I think there's, you all need to get a pitch for you. I'm the entrepreneur financial advisors, and some of those guys are going to hit, you know, like in our group. Mm-hmm. We had one hit last week.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Kirby Winters.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Kirby Winters sold Solar Velocity last week. And he's going to start help actually teach over at Kennesaw. But, yeah, so you know, they're going to hit, and when they hit, it's big news, and it's good news. So that's just the part of the EA platform here. I would share with the entrepreneurs, be receptive to you all coming to them before the liquidity event.
Correct.
And secondly, 10 years, that's – What are you looking at here? You're looking at another 10 years, or what's the game plan here?
I'm having fun, and I'm young, still got a lot of energy, so I'm not in any hurry. I want to keep growing us. There's a lot of countries I'd like to be operating out of. We've been trying to do something in Europe now for about a year, and we've kind of got our eyes on Antwerp, setting up an office there, and I've always wanted to have a reason to go to Europe and, you know, write off my travel expenses. So
that's the way to do it.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm not in any hurry to do anything, and I want to keep. We're having fun, and we like what we're doing. We feel good about it, and that's the path we're on.
What about Middle East?
Still scares me a bit.
Yeah, you know, especially I spent a good bit of time in the Middle East, and there's no doubt there's some troubling signs that the small group over there is casting a pretty big shadow over it. But there's still a great of respect for Western civilization, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. Well, Bill Kring, I understand you got to leave here. We appreciate you sticking with us long. I'm sorry, I'm having a lot of fun here. I'm running over more than I usually do. We usually are wrapped up by now. So, Bill, I really appreciate you coming in today.
Thanks, Cliff, for having me. It's a good time. Appreciate it.
All right, Bill. Thank you very much.
Hey,
so, you know, the Middle East is there's a great admiration for the Western civilization. It's well-educated, great families, great people. I mean, it's just that certainly, though, you know, having traveled in Egypt and Syria, spent a lot of time in Syria and Beirut, you know, it might be one of those instances where the small group of bad guys win.
Well, you know, when we look around, I mean, most of our sales are still in North America. We do quite a bit. You know, the European market's growing for us, but you know, our job, like I said, is to find those regions of the world where whatever the product is, it's best suited to make that product. It might be the U.S. It might be Vietnam, China. China was pretty much the only game in town for 15, 20 years. And now as China's gotten more expensive, you're finding other places are able to compete with China.
Vietnam's a great place.
Yeah, and I mean, the analogy I used to use, it would be like knowing that you could always go to your local grocery store and everything in your grocery store was the best price and tasted pretty good. And what's happened now is all of a sudden you can buy your milk and eggs across the street at another grocery store for less money. And so for it to make sense to buy all your stuff but those two items and get back in your car and go to another grocery store, you have to save a good bit of money to justify it. But there's all kinds of variables you got to consider. It's not just the labor cost or the currency, it's reliability, it's the know-how of the people in the region, it's, you know, whether or not they can keep the lights on with the power, it's corruption. There's a whole bunch of things that have to be considered when you look at a different region to manufacture.
Yeah, and you know, you and I were talking about it before the show. You know, if people don't get the expertise of someone like your company, you know, even a great company like Dell went headstrong over to India and
came barreling back because of just the, you know, the customer service issues, and all of those issues could have been avoided, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, you got to have feet on the street. There's no doubt about that. You got to have, you know, a lot of our products are made in facilities that we own. When it's not in a facility we own, we've got quality people, engineering people, logistics people. There's about 100 of these that we don't own that are making things for us, but we keep a very close eye on things. And a lot of our customers are companies that tried to go down this path themselves and failed.
Right. Do you know Guan Ming over at Wombo Carlisle?
I know Guan Ming very well.
Oh, yeah. She's part of our group.
Oh, she is. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
She's been...
I'm involved in the China Research Center. She and I are both founders of that.
Oh, really?
And also on the Georgia-China Alliance. I get to see her. She's great.
Yeah, she's a great person. Lewis, I guess she's probably been on just about everything we've done on China.
Yeah.
Correct.
Panels.
Well, she and I are often involved in speaking engagements together. We've been on panels together and so on.
Oh, very nice. Very nice. Well, all right. Well, we've gone over here, and I hope all of our listeners have stayed with us, because this has been a fascinating show on, I think, one of with Scott, what a big idea to bring value, and with Lewis and Bill, is something we face here. You know, sometimes life's not fair, and with Wall Street and everything right now, you guys are out there getting it done. And in fact, I want to mention with EA and your firm is we got a group membership for 401k. It's a group member plan. So, which greatly reduces the cost as well as the liability. If someone's under a group plan, and any liability is shifted to the sponsor, is that correct?
Well, that is the thing to emphasize, is that it's a multiple employer plan, and Entrepreneur Advisors, I think it's a great move for your business, Entrepreneur Advisors.
We do it as a benefit to the members, yes. That's
right, but the thing to emphasize, several things, but most importantly is that the plan sponsor, remember you mentioned before that a CEO is too busy to have to deal with all of the duties and responsibilities of sponsoring a 401k plan. So in a very big company, they'll have a committee, they'll hire a big consulting firm, but still the fiduciary duty exists. With the multiple employer plan, the employer is saying, I'm going to give up my duties of being the role of being a plan sponsor,
right,
and I'm going to join this other plan. But they still get the benefits of pooling, and it's cheaper. They don't have to deal so much with the audit cost, and so it's been out there a long time, but they're coming to the forefront now because of the increased enforcement coming out of the DOL.
All right, very good. All right, just some announcements here coming up for Entrepreneur Advisors. November the 16th, Maserati, one of our sponsors, is going to fly about 10 entrepreneurs to Savannah for a dinner. And Natalie Allen will be from CNN will be there. She's going with us, and we'll be talking about communications, crisis communications, and we will fly down there for dinner and fly back. And that's also thanks to David Brown, who owns JetLink, that's also a member of EA. So there's a member, David Brown, and a sponsor getting together to offer, I think, a nice trip to Savannah. Please let me know if you're interested in coming on the trip. There's like 9 seats on the plane, but we'll also have people there driving down in cars. So that's going to be in Savannah. That's coming up. November 18th is our next symposium. In fact, Scott, I think your president is Jeff Sweeney, is that correct?
I'm the CEO. Jeff's in charge of marketing. He's CMO.
He's CMO. Jeff is CMO. Jeff was at our symposium,
right,
on the panel where he was on the CEO panel. That's why I thought he was
there
president.
There.
All you got to do is change one letter in it.
Yeah.
M-D.
So we switch business cards.
There you go. November 18th, our next symposium. And Lewis, did you see that? That's over at Georgia State.
I did see that.
That's at the new Buckhead Center. Georgia State University, they got some very high-tech classrooms, and they're bringing in their best and brightest professors. Ding for Core is great. We usually have it at Four Seasons or Cobb Energy Center, but We're going to be doing it at the Buckhead Center that day. So it's going to be got the CEO of Blue Earth Link, CEO of Yellow Pages, me.com, and a lot of other CEOs, maybe even the CEO of Greenhouse Coffee. He is definitely trying to get it on his schedule to be here. So that is on November the 18th. And then on November the 28th is EA Connect. And that's where Jeff Pedowitz, y'all know Pedowitz?
I've met him.
Jeff has got like the fourth fastest growing company in Atlanta. He's going to be here, and we're going to be talking about shared partners and strategic partners, and Jeff's going to be hitting that meeting. So we got a big November coming, and we hope all the EA members will put it on your schedule. Do get the one on the 18th. We usually cut it off at 200. This one's going to be cut off at 100. So, Lewis, make sure you get your thing in. Scott, we'd love for you to join us. If look at your schedules, we'd love to have your firm part of all of us here. But more importantly than that, we thank you for coming today for our EA Business Radio. We appreciate you coming over. And, Lewis, as always,
thank you.
This is like our golden child for membership. Lewis.
Thanks, Cliff. Great to be here.
It talks us up out there, and we appreciate that. I'm at dinner sometimes or lunch. People go, you know, Lewis Brown was. By the way, Lewis Brown knows everybody.
I'm old, Cliff.
Steve Barkowski. I don't care if it's Steve Barkowski or a CEO of a Fortune 100 company. And I couldn't understand why. I was like, I came back to the office one day and I told Zena. I said, Zena, you know, everybody knows Lewis Brown. Well, and you trained them all on golf.
Well, I think that's a big part of it. I was sort of known around town as a guy that could help people hit the ball a little better. So that helped build the network
that
a little bit.
That built your network. Yeah. So, but thanks, everyone. This is EA Business Radio, and this is Cliff Oxford, and we thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Cliff.
See you. Bye-bye.